Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
David Hunter, Chief Macro Strategist at Contrarian Macro Advisors. You were on the show last summer in August, if memory serves, and you told listeners about your idea that there would be a dramatic melt up that would be caused by central bank liquidity injections and other measures. And anybody who's been paying attention to markets the last couple of weeks could reasonably point out that this is exactly what's happened here with the Fed and other central banks, mainly the Fed, stepping in to combat the coronavirus impact and unleashing all kinds of liquidity. So I guess that would be the first question for you is, where we stand with this, and if this is indeed the start of this melt up.
Sure. Yeah, I think this is definitely the start of what I think will eventually become a parabolic melt up into a secular top. In all honesty, when we talked last, I guess it was late August, I didn't anticipate the coronavirus by any means and didn't anticipate that we'd get down under 2,200 on the S&P. I thought we might. In fact, in January, February, March, I was talking about, or January, February, early March, I was talking about a correction back to 3,000, maybe 2,900. But I certainly didn't see the cascade that we got. So, the coronavirus certainly affected the path, but my target of 4,000 plus on the S&P, which I had last summer, is still my target today. We had another leg down. It took us down to a deeper bottom, but I think it didn't change the fact that we are going to have this final melt up into a secular top, a top that I expect to be the high water mark for decades to come.
Wow, yeah, okay. Right, I mean, I guess you mentioned it. The coronavirus has impacted everything, and it's actually nice to hear you admit that you didn't call it. A lot of people who were bearish last year are claiming that everything happened exactly as they predicted, including the coronavirus. But obviously, I don't think anybody could have predicted this. Nevertheless, the response from the central bank is pretty much what you predicted. Do you think that this response was adequate, was it reasonable in light of the threat that the coronavirus posed to the economy?
Yeah, I'll take you back even farther, well before we talked, but over the last several years, I have talked about a coming global deflationary bust, and I started using those three words in a combination way back as early as 2013, and it's now kind of common lexicon out there, but back then, nobody was using those three words in combination. But I've been talking for many years about when this cycle ended, it would end in a global bust, the likes of which we had not seen before. And I use the term bust to describe something that is probably on the magnitude of a depression, what happens in a much faster, more concentrated period of time. So as opposed to a recession, it's deeper and steeper. as opposed to a depression, it's not drawn out like the Great Depression was. So that's my, and people throw around the term bust, and I think too often the term is misused, but that's my definition of what a bust is. And that's what we're seeing right now. I would say that when I start talking about this, I said it'll end in massive quantitative easing across the globe. You will see every central bank throw money into the system unlike ever before. And so that's what we're getting now. I think this is the front edge of that bust. I think you get the final run-up into a secular top in spite of the fact that we've started the bust because of all of that liquidity that's being pumped. And then, unfortunately, another shoe drops, and we have a much steeper, deeper part of the bust probably late this year and first half of next year. You know, that's kind of how I see it. Obviously, the coronavirus speeded things up a bit, but it was the massive leverage in the system that caused me to say that when this cycle ends, you're going to see something we've never seen. Basically, I use the term Ponzi scheme for what has developed over the last four decades. We have just debt beyond anything we can ever manage. And when you get these surprises, that leverage really exacerbates whatever downturn you get.
Yeah, okay. So I want to make sure, where are we then in the cycle now exactly? Because we had this big bust in March, right? Really just for about 2 weeks. And you say that was the start of it, right? And followed by the liquidity injections by a central bank, specifically the Fed, leading with the Fed, that has now started this melt up, which you say will last until fourth quarter with a target of 4,000 on the S&P?
Actually, I think the melt-up's going to happen much faster than that. I am basically saying, and of course things can change, but I expect the S&P to exceed 4,000 by Labor Day and probably sooner than that. So I expect the top to be in this summer. And the second shoe to drop, or the second piece of the global bust, to hit after that. So we all want nice, neat things where, okay, the market peaks and then you get a bust. But unfortunately, because of the way this has happened and because you're getting money beyond anything that's ever been pumped before, you can get this run-up in the market in spite of the fact that the bust is not going to leave us. We're not going to start the bust and then not. We will have, I think, some sort of a V recovery for a quarter, maybe two, because of all this money. But ultimately, it's all one bust. I mean, we are at what I describe this as is the front edge of the bust, and then we'll see, the much bigger part of the bust later. The damage has been done. Money can fix things in the short run in terms of the markets and particularly, the bond markets and can postpone some of the worst of this, but the damage has been done. We shut down first the second largest economy in the world completely, or almost completely, and then the first largest economy in the world in terms of the U.S. So that's unprecedented. And so you can fix some things. You can certainly provide people liquidity and money to get by before they can be reemployed, but you're going to see an awful lot of damage that was done not get repaired. At least not anytime soon. So we'll be dealing with other aspects of this as we go along, but that does not preclude this big rally. And I think you're overwhelming the market with money. And that's not, by the way, that's not what the Fed is intending. I hear that all the time. Well, the Fed's just propping up the market. No, the Fed is doing what they should do, and I think that was a question you asked a while ago. I do think what the Fed is doing is absolutely necessary. I was probably as critical as anybody on Wall Street of Jay Powell, maybe the most critical analyst out there of Jay Powell for the last 2+ years. I will tell you now, I'm in his corner. I'm saying he has moved up the learning curve very rapidly in the last few weeks, and he's on board now and I think doing the right thing. So we always knew he was a smart guy. My problem was He was a lawyer, not an economist, and had limited experience in monetary policy, and he was way behind the curve all through the last 2 years. By the way, cheerleaded on by much of Wall Street. I would say it was the common narrative on Wall Street was that the Fed was too easy and needed to shrink the balance sheet and normalize interest rates. And he listened to that. And I kept saying, don't listen to the consensus on Wall Street. They're wrong. And now we're seeing why.
Yeah. Interesting. So because a lot of what we see here, the commentary from Wall Street and elsewhere, there seems to be a debate that, of course, a lot of this is short-term focused, right? So people are saying, well, we're going to revisit the lows of March. Just watch. This is a dead cat bounce. And everybody else is saying, don't fight the Fed. Buy now. This is going higher. But from what you're saying, it sounds like these can both be true, that this bounce will last a lot longer maybe than people were anticipating if it goes into the summer in Labor Day. And on the one hand, but then also that it is going to result in a drop, in a pretty cataclysmic drop from the sound of it, what you're saying. What are your targets on the downside once we get after Labor Day and once that happens?
Yeah, so let me just clarify that. I call it the retest narrative is kind of the consensus narrative out there that this rally is, you know, nearly done. You've retraced 50% of the drop that we had in March, and that we're going to roll over and retest. And, of course, many thought we were going to retest from 2,500. So it's gone, you know, 200 or 300 points higher, and now they're saying, okay, here it is, we're going to retest. So that's the retest narrative that's out there, and I totally dismiss that. I don't think we're going to go back to the lows anytime soon. The time we revisit the lows is after we have this final leg up into a secular top. So I don't use the term retest when you go back after another up leg to a higher high. So I think the retest narrative is just wrong. I could be wrong, but at least that's how I see it, is that we're going to have pullbacks along the way, but I don't think we're going anywhere near the lows again until we get back up over 4,000 on the S&P. So, so in terms of the next, what follows the final leg up is what I am calling a bear market of historic proportions. I expect a peak to trough decline from that high. And that high might be 4,000 on the S&P, it might be 4,500. You know, 4,000 is my minimum expectation. So from that high this summer, I expect an 80% peak-to-trough decline. So, you know, if it's 4,000, it takes you down to probably 800 on the S&P. If it's higher, it won't get quite that far down. But so the biggest, basically the biggest bear market since the 29 crash.
Yeah.
And it's an unwind of, you know, decades of, you know, debt buildup to leveraged levels. We have $250 trillion in global debt, and what people don't talk about, which I consider, you know, another form of leverage, is we've got quadrillions in notional value of derivatives. And those are both tools of leverage that work great on the way up and is why we've had, you know, reached the heights we have. But they really punish you on the way down. So I think and they also speed up any declines. Mm-hmm. So I think the unwind, you know, an 80% decline can happen faster than what we saw in 2008-09. So we can go from peak to trough in less than 6 months.
And you think there's enough systemic stress in the system to warrant that kind of sell-off? Like, where are the, like, that would kind of involve a lot of problems in the economy, I would suspect. And you speak of the debt buildup and things like that, but somehow things are going to have to,
We're looking at it right now. Look at where we are today, and you really, you know, you can become pretty dire about coming out of this. I know there are people out there that want to say, you know, you get the economy back working and everything's fine again. As I said before, I think there's a lot of damage that's been done that will not be repaired with money. And and again, if we didn't have leverage on the system like we've never had before, you could possibly have the time to repair things and not have, you know, the freight train coming at you from the other direction. But the problem is, with all that leverage, it doesn't buy you time. You know, you really things have to get turned around very quickly, and it's not within, I think, any policymaker's ability to do what needs to be done. I mean, massive money, and by the way, I've said this for many years, the Fed balance sheet, and I was saying this when the Fed, when the narrative on the street was the Fed needs to shrink the balance sheet, get down from, you know, $4.5 trillion down to $3 trillion or whatever, and maybe lower. And I was saying what we're going to see in the bust is the Fed balance sheet grow to $20 trillion or more.
Wow.
And I think it's going to be more. So we're probably moving pretty rapidly towards $10 trillion.
Right.
But when that second shoe drops, I think we'll roll right past $20 trillion, maybe even go to $30 trillion. I don't know. But that's the problem, is when you have an unwind of leverage, you have no choice. I realize there are a lot of people out there, a lot of people on Wall Street that want to say, let it break. You know, just let the system cleanse. Don't try to prop it up. You know, as I say to people that say that, if we follow that prescription, we'll all be living in a cave. You just can't allow a system that's leveraged to the degree this one is to just unwind. And even if you want to argue that point that it's going to come one way or the other, so do it, it's not going to happen. I can, as I say to people, I don't moralize or theorize, I forecast. And I can tell you that what's predictable more than anything else is how the policymakers are going to respond. It's pay me now or pay me later. You know, if they are slow to respond, it just means they're going to be responding in a much bigger way, you know, days or weeks later. You know, there's no policymaker that's going to just let this thing unwind and watch millions of people suffer.
Right. But then the flip side of that is that, you know, these injections of liquidity seem to work, right? If you go back to 08 and 09, they kind of worked then, salvaging the economy. And more recently now, they've worked again. And it looks, or maybe you're saying that they won't. But the point is that, like, once there's a bigger crash, can't they just do the same thing and just, you know, unload even more stimulus?
Yeah, there's a few answers to that. One is, as I said before, the money will certainly drive the market higher, at least for a time being. The money will certainly help postpone problems in the credit markets. The money can put businesses back on their feet, but there's so much slippage in that. There's a lot of things you can't reach with money and a lot of things you can't fix. And, of course, we're also dealing with a virus that is beyond anything we're used to dealing with, and it's going to take time to get that fixed. You know, a vaccine will go a long way, but you know, the optimistic views on that are that, you know, we could have a vaccine within a year, year and a half.
All right, David Hunter, Contrarian Macro Advisors. I want to take a short break and then come back and ask you some more questions about this very interesting topic. But let's first take a short break.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
All right, welcome back. We are back. David Hunter, Chief Macro Strategist at Contrarian Macro Advisors. You have a big following on Twitter, where your handle is Dave H. Contrarian. I'm active on Twitter as well, as we all know. This is the segment of the show where we talk to our guest a little bit about his or her background and how he or she came to this stage of his or her career. And we didn't do that last time when I had you on in August, I think. So I was very much looking forward to making up for it now. So maybe you can tell our guests a little bit about how you got started in this business, a little bit about what your education was like, and what brings you to the present day.
Sure. So I'm going on 47 years in the business. I was a finance major way back in college, and knew I wanted to get into the investment business. So right out of college, took what I could get, and at that point, back in 1973, I was able to get into a bank investment department and work my way through 8 years of bank investing. As I say, early on, I was lucky because it was a small enough bank where our investment people did both bank portfolio, which is mostly, you know, the bank's bond positions, and then also trust portfolio, which was, you know, involved a lot more equity investing. So I got both. If you go to a big bank, you usually kind of have to choose one or the other. So I was kind of exposed early on to both, and I think that really helped my macro skills to be able to do that. And then back in the early 80s, ended up with Textron, which was a Fortune 100 company where they had pulled all their money in-house and were managing their pension money in-house. And I went in there as their equity guy. They had been very much a bond house and a private placement house or shop until they realized in the 1980 market that they missed the energy stock run-up, and it dropped their performance down from top quartile. So they brought me in. I was told by the street to be careful because it was a dead end for equity investors. And I was pretty confident, you know, wet behind the ears, 30 years old or thereabouts, and thought I knew everything about investing. So I went in there saying, I can do it. And I basically started early on from late 1981 saying, we're in a bear market, but this will end, and, you know, let's get our ducks in line to, you know, put money into equities when the time is right, because they had a very low equity position, which is why I was hired.
What year is it?
I joined them in December of 81, and in August of 82, which was the bottom of the market, I went to the investment committee and said, I think it's time. We started putting money in. I went from when I joined them, they had 10% in equities, and most of the equities they had were really low float equities, you know, almost private placements themselves, you know, just companies that were not really in the mainstream of equity business, just kind of things they understood from a private placement standpoint. I took them from that 10%. By the time I left 5 years later, to 50% equities, and the pension assets had doubled, so it was, you know, 50% of a much larger pot at that time too, and it was because from almost day one of putting the money in, I had top one percentile performance for the 5 years I was there, so that kind of. As I said, I dragged them kicking and screaming because they kept saying, you know, their former chairman had been G. William Miller, who went on to be the Fed chairman back then, and they'd say, and they respected him greatly, and they'd say, G. William Miller said we should never do this, you know, we should never put equities, you know, have heavy equity emphasis because of what happened in the 74 bear market. And it took just the credibility building of time where we just kept putting more money in because the performance was so good. So that, yeah, that kind of set my career off, where I went from there to running. I went to Fidelity for several years running pension money, and then was ultimately was a chief investment officer. I ran the Hartford's active equity area for a few years, and then went as chief investment officer of a firm on Madison Avenue in New York. So. So it was kind of a winding path to a career. And then that was early 90s, mid-90s, and about the late 90s I started, I went off on the sell side as a macro strategist, and I've been doing that ever since.
Wow, so that's a very long career. 47 years is, interestingly enough, probably longer than anybody else who's on Twitter, I surmise to say. But
there are a few of us out there, but probably not very many.
Yeah.
And it really is, as I say to people, it's a different thing when you've lived through these cycles as opposed to reading about them. You know?
Yeah, I bet. Right.
It really, and you learn pieces along the way. Every cycle was different, and you really learn. So I certainly, where I am today as a strategist, and I have a lot of conviction on my calls, typically because I have that experience behind me.
And this whole history, of course, I'm curious, like, what it was like in the 70s. Was there still a living memory of the Great Depression and the 29 crash? And was that still around there to kind of shape the narrative of things, or was that mostly gone at that point?
Yeah, that was mostly gone. I think you had a long bull market from the early 50s,
right,
post-World War II through the 73 peak, which was the Nifty 50 peak.
Right.
And so, you know, when I came in, actually, I credit a lot of my value orientation and you know, risk-averse style to the fact that I came into this business very close to the peak of the 73 bull market, the bull market that peaked in 73. So you had the Nifty 50, basically, the top 50 stocks,
mm-hmm.
you know, dominated the run-up. It was a very narrow market into a top. And then you had, up until 2008, basically the worst bear market we had had in the post-World War II era. It was
right.
It was a horrendous market. And so I learned very early on, and I had a good boss at the time. We did good avoiding a lot of the risk. And I learned very early on the importance of, you know, the risk side of the equation, not just the return side.
Mm-hmm.
And I credit that. And it kind of set my career off in the right path.
Mm. Interesting. Yeah, of course, one thing that does come to mind with, you know, such a long career and something that I like to ask all guests who've been around for a little while now is how this current crisis compares to the ones that you've lived through. Or if the easy answer, of course, is that it doesn't, which in some ways, of course, is true. But what would you say there?
Yeah, there are always similarities in some mm-hmm. of the things, but for sure, this is something that I've never seen before, we've never experienced before. You know, I was I got a lot of pushback because I was calling for this bust, and people said, you're not going to have another 2008-9 so quickly on top of it. Usually that's mm-hmm. a once-in-a-generation thing. And I said, one of my arguments in this is we're at the latter end of a super cycle. And I describe super cycles as a cycle. The super cycle is the long cycle that
mm-hmm.
starts after the last depression and ends with the next depression. So, you know, the Great Depression was the last depression. We've had lots of recessions in between, but now we're in what I would say the last decade of that super cycle. And those super cycles just get more volatile with ever greater risk as you move towards the end of it. So,
mm-hmm.
and they also move to a more, you know, to a parabolic. So,
mm-hmm.
That's a lot of why I think we're seeing what we're seeing. It's, you know, certainly the virus couldn't have been predicted, but something else would have come along to create,
right.
you know, a bust. So I don't think we have ever seen anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
We've never been so leveraged as we are today, and certainly not right. from a magnitude of dollars. Certainly you've had leverage at the end of the 20s, and
yeah.
it was one of the reasons why we had the Great Depression. But when you look at the massive dollars and the massive currencies of and massive debt across the globe, we've just never been here before.
Mm-hmm. Couldn't you make the point that like 08, 09 was somewhat of that event? Because a lot of this, if, you know, you'll forgive this, is a lot of this really is vocabulary, right? Like the term depression was a pretty common one if you go back into the, you know, the 19th century and the early 20th century. Like what we now call recessions, I think they kind of called depressions. I don't think the term recession was even around then. And
yep.
post-war, as you know, there hasn't been a depression, but the 08-09 thing, I mean, they call it the Great Recession, which is, I think, completely wrong, because it wasn't, I mean, it was something that was created by financial engineering and a whole bunch of other things, and obviously leverage in the housing market and some insanity there. But this, to imply that the recession itself was great, I think is inaccurate, but that's another topic for another day. But the point is that, couldn't you make the point that 08-09 was that unwind and was that depression?
Yeah, I would disagree, actually, because I am big on terms. I do think some people think it's semantics, but I do think we need to have common terms. I view a depression, and I think the general definition of a depression, is something that's long-lasting. You know, it's a deeper downturn that causes greater hardship and lasts longer, and maybe that's because the Great Depression lasted most of a decade, but that's what I would say is a depression. Recessions, you can have recessions within the depression, and so you had a recovery after 32, and then you had another leg down. So I think we get too often I see this on Twitter a lot. People see terms used, and then they start throwing the term out and they misuse it. So last February and into March, people were saying we were in the melt up, and of course I had been talking about a coming melt up, and I kept saying this isn't the melt up. You know, you'll know the melt up when you see it. It's going to be, this is a great rally, but this isn't the melt up. And the same thing with the bust. People use the bust for every time the market goes down sharply, they say, oh, there's the bust. That's not when I'm referring to a bust, as I said before, it's something in between a depression and a recession. So I do think time is what separates a depression from a recession. And, I get what you're saying about using the term great in the same text with recession seems kind of an oxymoron, but I accept it because it's saying it's a bigger recession than we normally have. You know, it's something that was bigger than our normal recession, but not quite a depression. I actually think, and I've been saying this for quite a while, that when the bust hits, the reason why I was so sure it wasn't the end, that we would have a recovery cycle of significant magnitude, is because in deflation, the Fed has virtually unlimited ability to print money, because the reason you stop printing money is because you fear inflation, right? Well, in deflation, they will print, and if it's a deflationary bust, they're going to be dealing with what's right before them, as we are now. You know, the economy shut down, people are out of work, the capital markets are, at very high risk. They're going to be dealing with that and worrying about inflation later. And so they figure they can take back the money later if need be. We got to deal with what's right before us. So, and I predicted that. I mean, when people were saying the Fed's almost out of bullets because rates were at 1%, Fed fund rate was at 1%, I'd go, or 1.5% or 2%. They'd say, they don't have the normal room to lower rates. I go, but rates are only part of the equation. They will have unlimited ability to print money, like they've never had ability to print money before, because we haven't been in deflation since the 30s. So, and that's exactly what you're seeing now. Is the mentality is rates are close to zero. The Treasury can sell bonds, and at least the cost from an interest rate standpoint is low, if almost non-existent. And the Fed can print money, and the cost in terms of it starting an inflationary fire seems to be not present. Now I will say that what I believe follows this is going to be our first inflationary recovery cycle since the 1970s, and that's where I have a huge advantage. I lived through, that was where I cut my teeth, was in the 70s and the early 80s. Most people today investing have never seen an inflation cycle. They've only seen disinflation. That's what I think will come out of all this money. And as I say, it could be 20 or 30 trillion before we're done. and every other central bank doing proportionally similar. So we will see a global inflationary cycle, probably even that exceeds the one that ended in, 20% inflation back in 1980-81. Mm. But the inflation is not this year. It's probably not much next year. It will build fast once we get beyond 2021. I think we could go from zero inflation and actually negative, probably negative 3, 4, 5% inflation, inflation, so deflation, to what I think will be 20% inflation within one decade and less. Mm. It could be 6, 7, 8 years. Mm. So it will ramp up fast once it gets going, but you're probably 2 years away from that being the case.
Mm. Do you think the Fed's going to come in and buy stocks before this is done?
I would not be surprised. I don't think they'll do it here. It won't be during this leg. I think if it happens, it'll happen, in the 80% bear market. And I'm not sure. I wouldn't be surprised. I think they're going to buy anything they can. That's how you're going to get to 20 or 30 trillion in a balance sheet. I mean, we throw around trillions like we used to throw around millions,
Yeah, a trillion here, a trillion there, pretty soon you're talking about real money, right? Yeah.
Exactly, and it's huge. So I would, they've taken the step almost to there by supporting the junk bond market. So I don't think it's a leap to think they will get there, but I would tell you it's not between now and this, the top here, not between now and the summer. I think when that second shoe drops, we'll see things we've never seen before. So,
one thing, and this is maybe outside the confines of your expertise, but when it comes to these type of depressions and these major cataclysmic events in the economy, I like to say it's a little bit like physics. There's always an equal and opposite reaction. And we all know what happened in the 30s in terms of geopolitics and stuff. And there's always kind of not always, but very often a nasty undercurrent or some kind of effect of economic malaise that people weren't anticipating, where civil society starts to disintegrate a little bit or a lot even, right? And it hasn't happened here. But, you go look outside, you look at, places like Venezuela, there's a number of, at any point in history, there's going to be a number of failed states that are existing. So I'm wondering if you've thought about that at all and about the effects of this, meltdown and this next depression or whatever it is and what might happen there. And maybe not even over the long term, but just over the short term, if we talk about the timing of this, if this happens in September, October, there's a little bit of this little election coming up here in November where a certain president is looking to be reelected. And one would think the chances of that are not going to be very good if there is a massive meltdown in the third and fourth quarter. But, so I was just wondering how you thought about all those topics.
Yeah, I think for sure you're going to see politics change. You're going to see we're already – it's amazing. We were talking about universal income, Andrew Yang, certainly that was his platform. And, as a capitalist, I'd go, that's nonsense. What are you doing? You're not going to give everybody $1,000 or $1,000 a month or whatever they were talking. And now we're there. But I think it is different. I mean, I have heard people this past week say, these were, commentators on business shows asking the question, saying, aren't we basically endorsing that now? Aren't we really talking universal income? And aren't we going to see that going forward? And I thought, no, this is a response to an event nobody foresaw and where we had to shut down the economy. So that's quite different than kind of ongoing universal income for the less advantaged. But I do think socialism is certainly something that's going to keep pushing its way here because of what's going on. There's going to be a lot of insecurity and a lot of people willing to hold on to that, even though We were look around the globe, and it doesn't have a very good history. But in terms of anarchy or more, you know, higher crime, certainly you'll see it. I don't think as much right now. Probably to some extent in the second shoe drop part of the bust. But I think where the society really breaks down is following the next recovery. As I said, because of deflation, we have the ability to pull ourselves out of this as bad as it's going to be. Once you have that recovery cycle, if we truly go from negative inflation to 20% plus inflation, you've taken the central banks out of the ballgame. You know, they no longer have the ability to print money. And that's the only thing that extends this cycle. If, let's say, the Fed was not able to pump money in, pump liquidity into the system now, we'd just crater. As I said early on, you know, we'd all be living in caves. Because of, you know, no fears of inflation right now, they can print money because the reason for that, obviously, is there's a long lag time to when that money turns into inflation, you know, at least a couple of years, in my opinion. So they don't have to worry about it. You know, you're not seeing it now, so they can just keep printing. And but if you have high inflation, as we will, I think, towards the end of this decade, you know, after this next cycle, they've been taken out of the ballgame. Not to mention, if you have anything close to 15 or 20% inflation, you can have double-digit interest rates, and I don't know how we service our debt. You know, so there's going to be a lot of things that will tie policymakers' hands, you know, 7 or 8 years out. That means that we won't be able to stop the next rollover. It will just keep going because we won't have anything to offset. You just can't keep pouring fuel on a inflationary fire. So that's when I think all hell breaks loose is we truly will see the unwind of what I call the great Ponzi scheme, where, you know, the debt, you know, this massive debt throughout the world, it's not just the U.S., it's throughout the world, just comes crashing down.
On the inflation thing, though, you know, when it comes to that, I mean, what do you make of the argument that, you know, the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency of the world, basically, and as long as there's demand for U.S. debt products, treasury and such, the U.S. is basically in a position where they can print money as much as they want to, right? I mean, you know, these are all fiat currencies. The only value that the U.S. dollar has is compared to other currencies. So if everybody's doing this, then what is the U.S. dollar going to devalue against other than gold, I guess? And that's a whole other argument. But so what do you make of that argument that, you know, the U.S. is in this position where inflation just doesn't seem to be a realistic concern at present? Like, what does it take for their inflation to become a real issue?
Yeah, I think the key phrase there is at present. I would agree with that right now. I think by the time you get into the middle of the decade, say 2025, 26, you'll be moving towards double-digit inflation, and that also means moving towards double-digit interest rates. When, you know, if we truly have, you know, the Fed moving towards $30 trillion in a balance sheet, it means the Treasury's also moved way up in terms of what it's floated, and you know, the math doesn't work. I don't know how we pay our interest. There's going to come a time, and again, I'm not talking about the next 2 years, but there's going to come a time in the next 5 or 6 years when I don't think U.S. Treasury debt is going to be looked upon in the same favor as it is today. So, yeah, I do think reserve currency helps us right now. But ultimately, I think once we really get pumping money, here's, you know, this is a good time to talk about the dollar, I guess. But my view is I'm one of, there's a lot of people out there very bullish the dollar right now, right? There's, you know, the whole dollar shortage story out there. And there is a dollar shortage because of the, you know, all the debt in the world that's denominated in dollars, and they need those dollars to service their debt. And because, as I, you know, my belief is because Powell was tightening when everybody thought he was easy or was behind the curve, he was creating this dollar shortage, and it kind of all blew up here in the last month. So the dollar's run up fast in the last, last month or 6 weeks, and I do believe we've seen a temporary top in the dollar, and that will go down. On my forecast is 85, 86 on the dollar here over the course of the next 6 months. So basically a 15% drop from here. And then I think it will move up in the second shoe drop, when the second part of the bust hits, people run to the dollar as they always do in crisis. So I think the dollar can go from 85 to 140 during the bust as people scramble for safety, and the safety of the U.S. But I think that's the last hurrah on the dollar. And I think during that inflationary recovery, gradually initially and then faster later, I think the dollar will fall way below 85. It'll go probably, could go to 50. I don't know. And a lot of it will be because of all the money we created, all the dollars we created around the world. So, I don't mean to say we're going to get there in a hurry. It'll play out over the next cycle, so several years. But I think the dollar is going to become probably less and less thought of as a reserve currency as we go through.
Don't you need something else to take its place, though? I mean, what are people going to do if they if they don't buy U.S. treasuries, right?
Like, yeah, that's a good question. I have a feeling we'll, and I have not been one of those that's been predicting the end of the dollar as a reserve currency. You've had that for the last 5 years.
I have not been one
of those. So down the road, yes, but not now. I'm guessing, probably the hardest part to forecast right now is what happens to China in all this. Because China, everything we say about the U.S., China is more leveraged than we are. And I think one thing that this coronavirus crisis has done is it has cemented in many, many people's minds on both sides of the aisle the fact that, and this is something that Trump was on early on, the fact that we gave away the store, and China basically took a lot of our manufacturing, and now we're seeing the downside of that. Yes, we got cheap goods. Yes, it was in a lot of ways beneficial to the consumer, but now we're seeing the other side of that, which is the supply chains are not trustworthy. And so I think the biggest part of the next boom, and I think we'll have a boom coming out of this bust, is going to be driven by infrastructure building, and a lot of that will be, you'll have roads and bridges and stuff the government's propping up, but you're also going to have, I think, a big, big onshoring of capacity again. So certainly in the drug area, you're going to see it. That I think is a given, but I think you're going to see it in steel mills. I think you're going to see it in auto manufacturing. I think you're going to see it in lots of other areas that we have, for decades, farmed out to China. So how does that affect China? Because I don't think we're the only country that's going to be doing that. Japan, I think, is showing signs they're going to do that. So, I think that's the part where I just can't forecast right now. Is China going to emerge from this next bust as the emerging leader of the world, economic leader? And then, therefore, follow that as, ultimately, kind of we followed Britain into a position of leadership, after World War One and into World War Two. And my thesis up till now was that China probably follows us, that we're going to be, somewhat second fiddle to them as they emerge as the, the engine. But now you have to wonder, have they flamed out? Did they bite off more than they could chew? And, they've kind of got the whole world basically awakened to their, who they are. So I'm not sure how that all plays out in terms of the U.S. and who replaces us, if anybody. You know, I hope I'm wrong about a depression that could last for more than a decade, and be something where, you know, what we emerge out of that depression would be something very different than a capitalistic society. I don't know. But that's down the road. We've got enough to worry about in the next year.
Indeed we do, yeah. I mean, having spent a little bit of time in Asia, I can tell you that absolutely nobody wants RMB, and that includes people in China. The amount of industries that exist just for people to get their yuan into something, preferably U.S. dollar or some kind of other hard currency denominated asset, is massive. And in fact, props up a lot of the economy of Hong Kong, if we're honest about it. But so, yeah, but whatever. It doesn't, for whatever.
But
for what
I agree
that's
with
worth.
That for the next few years, for sure. For the next probably 3, 4, 5 years, I don't worry at all about the dollar. But you know, it's really a question down the road. And, you know, again, there's a lot of questions that we can't answer right now in terms of China's been kind of making inroads in a lot of the international organizations, certainly the World Health Organization, we're seeing that front and center. But, you know, the IMF, et cetera, such that, you know, we take for granted that we're the leader of the world, and I'm just not sure that's going to be always the case.
It will be interesting to watch for sure. Fascinating conversation, David Hunter. Thank you so much for taking the time. In closing, maybe just tell our listeners where they can find out more about you. I've mentioned the Twitter already. I will be putting this in the show notes. Your Twitter, again, is Dave H. Contrarian. As we've heard, you've been contrarian your entire career, which, of course, makes you a preferred guest for us. But, yeah, where else can people find out more about you?
Sure. You can go to my LinkedIn page. I do write a quarterly investment letter that, you know, it's subscription-based. Has been an institutional letter, but I'm beginning to open it up to retail. You can go to my LinkedIn page, see a couple samples of previous letters, and see my background. Pretty much other than that, it's follow me on Twitter. And I will say, just in closing, because we didn't talk about it, I'm also, you know, pretty big gold bull here. I think we're going to see gold probably get up to easily 2,000 and may go, you know, a couple hundred points beyond that. I think silver can get to 26 here, and this is in this run-up to a top this summer. So I think they will be big players in that. And then I think in the inflation cycle that follows the bust, they will probably get hit hard in the bust, as with most assets. But I think gold can get above 10,000 in the cycle that takes us to the end of the decade. And silver could, you know, easily see 300. So just to kind of get that in there, because I do think they're going to be major players in terms of investments here.
Very good. All right. Thank you so much for that. And thank you all for listening. And we look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Some people might say coffee doesn't need chocolate, but you're not some people. You're a dreamer. You see the possibilities of chocolate and caramel flavors swirling together with cold brew, topped with velvety chocolate cold foam and cocoa caramel crumbles. That imagination can only be rewarded with Dunkin's new caramel chocolate cold brew. It's a cold brew dream come true. America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.